and welcome to a special Dream Lab series of the Price Lab podcast.
My name is Roberto Vargas. I am the humanities librarian at Swarthmore College.
So my name is Nabil Kashyap. I'm the digital scholarship librarian over at Swarthmore College. Roberto and I collaborated on DH in the classroom.
I'm wondering if you could both talk about what drew you to the material that you cover in your class and why you want to teach it.
I learned to do a lot of DH projects while I was right at Swarthmore by saying yes to projects when I didn't know very well the skill needed to complete those projects and just saying, I'm going to learn it. So a lot of it has been confined to the four walls of the classroom because those four walls seem like a clear framework where we've seen our own mistakes or our own process develop. Specifically with Jekyll, when you learn it, you start saying, this is much easier than a CMS. And then you realize a year later, actually, it's just a little bit easier. And then finally, you kind of learn better.
You know, if I really think about many DH projects that I interact with or encounter, some of them are, you know, durable and are oriented towards particular audiences and are just really useful. But most of them are not. And I think that's totally okay. Rather than worrying about products, worrying about scholarly outputs, that the site or the CMS or the digital artifact is ephemeral. It's just part of a process. It's maybe a fulcrum or a center for a constellation of iterative and collaborative activities and practices. It's just like a vehicle for potentially, not always, but potentially new or unfamiliar relations between students, faculty, and staff, maybe thinking differently, collaborating differently, investing time differently, reflecting on research questions in a way that they might not otherwise. I'm not trying to suggest that this is radical or particularly different, but I still think that it has this opportunity to kind of change those dynamics slightly. There is an element of doing the thing, of performing critique in whatever capacity that's available. So while thinking about infrastructures, worrying about software, engaging opportunities at a high level, thinking about those histories and those genealogies, it's so thrilling and potentially liberatory and, you know, all of those things. But in this context, I really feel like it's incomplete without having to engage in the interfaces, without making the thing. And on the other hand, you know, we could orient ourselves to just be sort of web development workshops where we just sort of build to spec or try to figure out what our users need and then, you know, go back to our little workshop and pump it out. That would belie the kind of importance of engaging in the syllabus and considering those infrastructures more intellectually and the messiness of actually trying to get something done. The classroom is a place where you can kind of perform the critique to do the thing in addition to thinking about it and also to kind of consider the ways in which, you know, these aren't products and they shouldn't be considered that way. These are actually just sort of high-level processes.
You know, a problem that people run into when they're trying to incorporate digital humanities, kind of whatever that means to them, into classes that they're teaching is that, you know, how quickly the digital part can take over all of the class time. So I'm wondering, you know, how you sort of deal with that problem, and do you have some strategies for incorporating technology but not getting caught in the trap of spending 90% of your time troubleshooting?
Something that Nabil and I have thought about has been the way when you're conversing with faculty and students about an assignment that is DH in the classroom, I have found myself kind of pushing or guiding them towards using a tool that I already know very well. Basically, I had the desire not to sound dumb. I'm like, oh, in my head, I'm thinking, I know this tool really well. Let me see what I can say to try to move them towards this. Now, that's sort of a disservice to the students and faculty in a way, but one of the advantages has been, because I know this tool very well, often I can anticipate all the troubleshooting.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, you know, I think there was a time when we talked about digital humanities as being very experimental, but listening to you, so there are things that are less experimental than others and might take up less time.
The thing that I emphasize as early as possible and as honestly as possible is to articulate sort of what degree is the technology part of this, whether it's a class or a project or a research question, like where does the technology fit, and just really trying to home in on that. And I think about it as one of the most pressing issues, you know, as pressing as finding funding or figuring out your research question or choosing a font. But there's so many options and avenues that we shouldn't feel wed to any particular tool or pathway. It may be incredibly important to this particular project to sweat it out, and that's core to how we're conceptualizing this. But we also may be able to step back and say, you know, ultimately this is really peripheral, and, you know, all of us working on a spreadsheet or simply interacting with a website, that will like accomplish our course objectives in a way that is meaningful, substantive, and actually more useful for the project. Instead of immediately, we're going to write scripts from scratch and realizing, you know, really that's not where the students are at. That's not what the commitment of the faculty member was in the first place.
I remember like several years ago, I had to go to EDUCAUSE, and I was so offended by the whole thing. Felt like I was going to have like a Jesus and the Money Changers moment, just start flipping over tables. It was so gross.
Yeah, I definitely remember the cover of EDUCAUSE. Maybe it was 4 years ago. Digital humanities, is it the future or something like that? My heart sank a little bit.
So digital humanities, I think, has tried to distance itself from what I might call the educational technology industrial complex. And it's that multi-million dollar for-profit industry that sells learning management systems and things like that. So I'm wondering if you also see the two worlds butting heads, or is there actually some kind of convergence that we need to think about?
Yeah, certainly I'm, you know, committed to digital humanities and the way that, you know, at least to the extent that it kind of offers a way of providing critique of the like software and infrastructures that we sort of live in and through. And I'm like, obviously as concerned as anyone by privatization in higher ed, and ed tech is like clearly leading that impulse or one of the sort of bellwethers. On the other hand, I see this sort of a hard and fast distinction between DH and EdTech as being a little bit elitist, and that I feel concerned if I draw too hard and fast a line, basically. So many of the vocal proponents in the DH community around open source, minimal technologies, and the like are themselves just really resource institutions like our own, you know, like Swarthmore College, and have the sort of excess staff time to deal with the sort of labor issues associated with these products and projects. And at the same time, I also see that as our systems become more sort of intertwined and complicated, and they're dynamic, you know, ownership changes over time, I want to be aware of those systems and the infrastructures and the histories and some of the impulses that are sort of shaping higher ed. But at the same time, I think it's unhelpful and maybe impossible to imagine separate systems or separating systems, or thinking about ways of engaging software and infrastructures that aren't already sort of public-private military partnerships. So for example, you know, when we were championing GitHub Pages and Lynda Learning a few years ago, you know, we certainly weren't thinking that we were going to be cheerleaders for Microsoft, but here we are. And so I do feel like there's an important distinction to be made, and there's a kind of an avenue for critique, but I also think that too fine or too simple a distinction is potentially unhelpful and maybe disingenuous. And so I think about that, you know, and there are so many institutions, you know, that are participating in technology in the classroom that really just don't have access. When you're a community college or a vocational school and you really just rely on your vendor service agreement, does that mean you can't participate in this discourse? Moral of the story is complicated.
What are you hoping your students take away from the class? Sort of concrete skills, but also sort of like ways of approaching issues.
How do you bridge the knowledge, the cognitive framework that you have about what it takes to write a 20-page paper? And how do you transfer that into what it takes to create a DH project?
we often come in contact with students and faculty who this is their first project. And so in our conversations and even in practice, the idea of having a site, it's like, oh yeah, it's very simple. And then they might ask you to do a little edit that in your head, you're thinking, oh man, this is gonna take forever. And so our hope was for the students of this class to be able to know and to have the language. When you're thinking about a project, knowing exactly how difficult it will be, like a big advantage. And I think that was one of the main things we wanted students to get out of this.
Is we're only trying to figure out exactly what Roberto just described, which is what is easy and what is hard. You know, how do you distinguish between those things? And it's like an ongoing revelation, honestly. I think that, you know, in terms of like high level kind of practices and orientations, I think that we really privilege resilience and the language around resilience. So rather than really imagining expertise or imagining, deep literacy with only one particular tool, you know, over the course of 8 hours a day, over the course of an entire week, really thinking about, you know, actually what are the kind of practices and attitudes and maybe even search bars of, you know, whether it means in yourself having confidence with technology or it means something very practical, like go to Stack Overflow, just go there, you know, cut and paste the error message. But really thinking about resilience. And again, this is in practice. Like I'm not convinced that this curriculum does this as well as I would like, but ways of thinking and doing that are common to both the sort of course-based, potentially mirror, you know, I'm those in air quotes, mirror sort of course projects versus multi-year grant-funded monstrosities, you know, what are the ways of thinking and doing that are common to both so that you don't feel that in your particular context you're constrained, nor do you feel when you're working on a larger project that your context is unique. And then probably the most important thing, of course, is just that it's generative, you know, that, you know, people come to this workshop and you see the sort of panoply of different kinds of projects that we've done, the different technologies that we use, the different level of time investment, looking at rubrics, looking at course plans, and that it's just generative of connections and ideas that are very immediately useful in one's own domain and one's own context. I think that, you know, obviously that's very challenging to do, but that's certainly what I hope for.
Thank you very much. Both of those were really good answers.
This special Dream Lab series of the Price Lab podcast was produced by Sarah Malinsky, program manager of the Price Lab, with additional editing and production by Penn senior Kia Da Silva and students from the Narrative and Listening in the Digital Age class at Penn, including Emmett Foley, Alexis Massino, and Kelsey Gibbons. We also want to thank Julie Beth Napolin and Clay Coleman for their expert advice, as well as all the Dream Lab instructors who were so generous with their time. This podcast was made possible with support from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation.